What is up, you fragments? Welcome to No Holds Barred, the Shakespeare podcast. Shakespeare would have listened to. I'm Dan Bollier.
And I'm Kevin Condardo. We are back with this month's So You're Going to See Shakespeare episode. The idea is that this episode is something you'll listen to in transit to a Shakespearean production so that we can prepare you to be the best little audience member that you can be.
An audio version of the dramaturgical notes, if you will.
So hopefully you'll enjoy this episode as you head out to see Coriolanus.
Here we go.
The first thing we need to cover before we get into this episode is a quick synopsis of the play so you at least know the story. Daniel.
Yes. We begin with the citizens of Rome protesting the high price of food and calling for the execution of the war hero Caius Marcius, despite the pleadings of the respected elder Menenius Agrippa. In the height of the chaos, an enraged Marcius enters and expresses his displeasure that such a rabble have representation in Rome. But before he can express that fully, word comes that the Volscians are attacking and Marcius is being pressed into service to defend the city.
Marcius leads his army to Corioli and attempts to parley with their leaders, but are turned away. The Romans attack, but are unsuccessful. Marcius, furious at his soldiers' cowardice, fights his way back into town by himself. Eventually, he connects with Cominius, another Roman general, and offers to join his troops in battling his longtime rival, the Volscian leader Aufidius. The two, Aufidius and Marcius, end up meeting in battle and fight to a draw, with both men escaping back to their respective armies, but not before Aufidius promises that, the next time they meet in battle, one of them will die.
After the Roman army emerges victorious, Marcius is celebrated for his victory. He, however, dismisses the accolades as he was only doing his duty. Cominius ignores Marcius' modesty, however, and awards him the title of Coriolanus for his noble work at Corioli.
Back in Rome, two new tribunes named Sicinius and Brutus are commenting to the people that Coriolanus's excessive pride is becoming a bit of a problem. Menenius and Coriolanus's mother, Volumnia, take exception to these rumors and make mention of the multitude of scars he has received in defense of Rome. Upon his return to the city, his friends put him forward for consul. He tells them he isn't terribly interested in governance, and he's doubly not terribly interested in courting the citizenry for the position. The Senate and the people appoint him regardless, but when they ask to see his scars, which is a standard request of war heroes, he refuses outright. This does not play very well.
The tribunes who didn't want Coriolanus appointed in the first place use this refusal to whip the people up into a frenzy, to the point where they demand Coriolanus be executed for treason. Menenius insists that Coriolanus receive a fair trial, during which the tribunes bait him into losing his temper again, further whipping up the people. Before they can banish him, however, he says he's leaving town of his own free will. The people rejoice that they've rid themselves of Coriolanus.
Coriolanus leaves Rome and goes directly to the Volscian camp where, in disguise, he asks to meet his old rival Aufidius. He explains to Aufidius what the Roman people did to him and offers to join the Volscians in their fight against Rome, as that would be Coriolanus' ultimate revenge against the citizens he hates so much. Aufidius is super into this idea.
Meanwhile, back in Rome, the tribunes turn out to be pretty lousy leaders and pay no mind to the reports that the Volscians are preparing an attack. However, their attention is grabbed fully and quickly when they hear that Coriolanus is now leading the Volscian army. Menenius takes this opportunity to remind everyone in Rome that they are a bunch of stupid idiots, and their only hope now is to beg Coriolanus for mercy before he burns Rome to the ground in revenge.
Back in the Volscian camp, however, Aufidius isn't too excited about how Coriolanus has taken control of the army and is refusing to follow the chain of command they established when Aufidius allowed him to join. Aufidius isn't sure how to handle this at the moment, but we'll put a pin in that for the time being.
The Romans start sending people off to beg Coriolanus for forgiveness. First Cominius, then Menenius, and then finally his mother Volumnia. Coriolanus ignores the first two, but is finally moved by his mother's pleas, even though he knows that he is dooming himself the moment he agrees to spare his city.
Coriolanus tells Aufidius he's not going to be able to help him attack Rome after what his mother made him promise, and Aufidius clear-headedly replies by calling him a treasonous coward and having all of his people stab him to death. So, yeah. That is Coriolanus. Now that you know what you'll be watching, we're going to take a few minutes to talk about where Coriolanus falls in Shakespeare's personal timeline and what was happening in the world when it was written. Daniel.
Yes. So, for Coriolanus, we're looking at scholars. The range here is pretty broad between 1605 to 1610, but for our purposes, we'll split the middle and go with 1608.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
That works.
Yeah.
So, I think the biggest thing... So, we know that this is late Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. We're looking at in the last... for 3 to 4 to 5 years of his career.
Yep.
I think something really interesting that happens this year familially for Shakespeare is his granddaughter is born, mm-hmm. Elizabeth Hall. She is baptized on February 21st.
1608?
1608.
Yep.
And this is the only granddaughter that he will know.
Hmm.
She's the last surviving descendant of Shakespeare, born to Susie and John Hall.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that knowing that he's writing a political play at the same time that he is for the first time a grandfather is really interesting in terms of family relationship.
Yeah.
And that sense of like generation to generation.
Yeah.
That he is for the first time two generations away from someone beloved is, it puts an interesting spin on Coriolanus.
Interesting. Right. Where there's, yeah, right. We have the generations.
Yeah.
Another major event that's happening in the country at this time, there was much civil unrest in the Midlands in England in 1607 and a grain shortage in 1608, the grain shortage probably echoing the grain shortage at the beginning of this play. And in that civil unrest that came from both of those events was particularly notable because unlike other civil unrests that we've spoken of in the late 1590s and the early 1600s that were related to religious or political upheaval, the only needs of the rioters in these instances was they had no food. There wasn't a political overtone. There wasn't a religious overtone. It was just a very hunger. Dangerous situation because of this lack of, you know, this famine, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is something that Shakespeare actually probably would have seen firsthand because it's funny that you mentioned Susie and John. He likely would have been in Stratford in June 1607 when they got married.
Okay.
And that was right in the thick of the Midland Revolt.
Oh, interesting.
So he might have seen these people that he's now putting on stage at the top of the show.
So it's that sense of like going on a vacation, but still like always working.
Always on the clock.
Mm-hmm. I'll use that later. Meanwhile, in other parts of the world in 1608, John Smith, the famous John Smith we've all heard about.
Of Pocahontas fame?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The John Smith was released by Powhatan in January. Later in that year, in September, he's elected the council president of Jamestown and begins European expansion on the North American continent.
Mm.
So this sense of like release by one group and then conquest in the name of another group is very, it's an interesting thing to be happening in the world at the same time that Coriolanus is being
written. Sure. And then just in terms of Shakespeare's timeline, this is actually the last tragedy that Shakespeare writes.
Huh.
After this, he wrote Timon right before this, likely.
That's a tragedy.
And then this.
No, the fact that he wrote it is a tragedy.
I know. And then this. And then after this, he goes into the romances, and then we're out.
Oh, interesting.
So this is the last tragedy, and one of the only tragedies where only the title character dies, and you don't end up with, you know, it's this and Timon, I believe, are the only two where it's only the title character.
Oh, that's really interesting.
He writes them back to back. Yeah.
That's really cool. For some love to the my people. Two things that happened in the world in 1608, again, outside of Shakespeare's England, but this is what's going on in the world. Samuel de Champlain founded Quebec City in 1608.
Oui. Bien.
And Old Bushmills Distillery was founded in Bushmills, Ireland.
In 1608?
In the same year that Coriolanus was written.
Interesting.
So here's a fake Bushmills to you, Bushmills.
That's why they were so upset about the grain.
That's right.
So there you go. Now you have a little background about what was going on in Shakespeare's time when this play was written. This is where we identify what we consider to be the most prominent theme in the play and particular places where you may see it come up. Dan has chosen his three favorites, yes. And I am going to pick of those three for us to dig in on. So, Dan.
Yes.
What are our finalists?
So, the finalists for best theme in Coriolanus are pride, responsibility versus obligation, and masculinity versus femininity.
Three excellent nominees.
Thank you.
But I think I'm going to go with pride.
Sure.
I think there's a lot to be spoken about with pride in this piece.
How about 4 minutes worth?
I think I got it. So obviously, pride is a major point for Coriolanus.
Yeah.
That his justifiable outrage when he comes back from saving Rome, that they're all like, were you really that great? And he's like, I took a town by myself, so that was pretty dope.
There's that.
And they're like, meh, you're overrated. And it's like, no, you're garbage.
Right.
That pride, and it's a deserved pride.
Sure.
That his outrage, but then that pride extends to when it's like, show us your wounds. And he's like, I'm not going to do that. And everyone's like, right. Dude, it's the political dog and pony show. This is like the equivalent of going to the pancake restaurant in New Hampshire before the primaries. Like, just go in there,
part of the
eat something that you would never eat under any other circumstances.
Yep.
Just smile and drink this, crap coffee, and then leave, and we'll get you your organic chai latte in the van, but just please do this for a second. He's like,
we
I'm not doing that.
Need to be relatable.
Yeah, exactly. So that, for him, I think also Aphidius has a pride that is, that is useful to play, both in that he is able to put his, these two are blood rivals that are like, but Aphidius acknowledges, like, I can beat everyone in the world except for you.
Right.
And he's able to swallow that pride to the point that he lets him come on board,
sure.
And work together.
Yeah.
He's like, all right, I mean, that takes a swallowing of pride to be like, yeah, you can, come on over. Until his pride is exhausted when Coriolanus takes over.
Yeah.
It's like, I got a limit.
A little too far there. There is that sense of pride in an honor system like ancient Rome, mm-hmm. where it's one thing to do something honorably, but pride is a sin.
Mm.
In that culture, it's like, you don't do it for pride.
Right.
Certainly don't do it for excessive pride.
Right.
You do it because that is your job.
Right.
So it is interesting. And that we see that, we hear that in the very beginning of the play,
uh-huh.
that the rabble are already talking like, he didn't do this for us. He did it for his pride.
Yeah.
Like, he's all, it's ego.
Yeah.
And whether or not that's true.
Well, it's fascinating that, like, he doesn't want the title of Coriolanus. Like, that he doesn't want it. He doesn't care. And it's like, no, you are in this. And he's like, whatever.
Right.
I'll take it.
I didn't do it for that.
Right.
I did it for doing it.
Right, because it's my job.
Right, and I like doing it.
Right.
And I'd rather be, it's major pain in that way.
Like,
I want to be killing people, not like I want to sit here and talk about it.
A major pain reference. Fascinating.
Well, it's based on Coriolanus.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Hmm. That's what I read that in the Wikipedia
in
page.
The folio, yeah, sure.
That's right, for the Damon Wayans folio. But there is also, to take the word on a bit of a journey.
Yeah.
The idea of a group of lions as a pride is an interesting context, I think, for looking at these characters.
Okay.
That it's like, Rome isn't, it is a political world, but it's a political world of lions as opposed to like.
Right.
There's something to that.
Well, even
imagery.
Right. Even the politicians who are like running circles around him and winding him up.
Yeah.
It's like they are prideful that what is this soldier going to do? Like, this is our job.
Yeah.
We are politicians. What is this outsider doing? Like, he can go and smack around, these other tribes or whatever.
Sure.
This is our job and he can't do this.
Not here.
Yeah. And it's like, if more people were able to, if more people were like Aphidius in this play, it probably, Aphidius would have gotten smacked around.
Right.
Rome was like, yeah, this is probably for the best. And Coriolanus is like, all right, fine. If this is what you want to do, like, fine.
Yeah, sure.
But they don't. And that's why we get a play.
And that's where the drama is.
There you go. So that is the best theme, Pride. Keep an eye out for it when you head out to see Coriolanus. In this part of the show, we choose which non-title characters we would most want to play in this piece and explain why in 2 minutes or less. I won the coin flip before the show.
Grab it.
And I've elected to go first, so here we go.
Wait, I'm going to go second.
No. My favorite character in this play is Aphidius across the board, even if I had my full slate of options. I just think he is the most interesting character in the play. In the same way that when I was growing up, I liked Donatello more than Leonardo.
Okay.
I feel like Coriolanus is very Leonardo.
Oh, interesting.
And Aphidius being the second best, not that Donatello was the second best, but being...
Michelangelo was the best. We all know that.
Michelangelo is so overrated. But since... Aphidius knows straight up one-on-one he cannot beat Coriolanus. And I think that is a fascinating, like, I'm the second best in the world at this thing and I can beat everyone but that guy.
So you wouldn't have to act really.
I'll come across the table right now. But I think that that's a very interesting character trait to play, that like he is so dangerous,
yeah,
but he just knows one guy has his number.
Yeah, sure.
And like he has to go through the play with that, and he has to lead his people like that. You know, think about that like, you know, he doesn't really have the scenes where he's rallying his troops, but like you could have like a Monty Python scene where he's like, all right, we're going to get in there and we're going to take Rome. And they're like, but what if Coriolanus is there? He always kicks your ass. It's like, all right, who said that?
Who was it?
Right? But it's an interesting thing that he needs to balance. So then when Coriolanus shows up, it's like, oh.
Right.
It's like, of course you can be on my side.
Yeah.
Like, instantly. It's
I've
like,
been looking for you.
You know? It's like he has other ways, you know, he has other skills that he needs to develop rather than just being like, I show up and I smash people.
Right, right, right.
So I would play Aphidius.
Nice. That's a good choice. For me, since Coriolanus is off the board, which is a tragedy for all of us listening, and myself included. Mm. I would go with... I did have Aphidius on the list, and I had... I wasn't sure where you were going to go, so I was like, I'd happily do Aphidius. But for the exact opposite reason, I think... And this is the person I had at the top of my list, is Menenius.
Uh-huh.
Menenius Agrippa, who I just think is so fun. He has some of the best language.
Yep.
He is in a play full of warriors and like beasts. Is like, I'm gonna just pull some strings. He's a man of patience and calculation, which
I, possibly the only one in this play,
right? But he's a survivor in that way, and he has. I just love in that first scene, he has like basically a parable, with the whole bit about like the stomach and its relation to the body, and just takes a rabble-rousing crowd and gets them to listen to him, tells a story, and in doing so, like, kicks them all in their own proverbials without them noticing it.
Right.
And then is like, I've got to go now.
Okay.
But, like, it would just be, I think, I also like the rhetoric in the Roman plays. Like, Shakespeare's rhetoric is strong.
Yeah.
And Menenius has some of the best.
Totally.
Like, he just has such great, and he gets, and then that scene when he gets called in, and he's like, I know you're going to kick her ass.
Yeah.
Please don't.
Like, like he knows it's not going to... He knows Coriolanus too well.
Yeah.
To like, they sent me to do this.
Right. It's pre-2000... I would just go back to pre-2004, being a Red Sox fan and being like...
going into the Yankee
going
camp.
Into any playoff game, being like, I know this is going to hurt. Just don't.
Right.
And, and any time I get to travel back to those days, I'm happy to.
So totally.
For that reason, I'd like to play Menenius Agrippa in Coriolanus.
And also, you get to be the one, you get an I told you so, which is always nice.
I told you so.
Right?
I love those.
Very good. So there you go. Those are our recommended roles. Let us know how they are played when you head out to see this production.
Probably less better than we would play them.
Obviously. This is the section of the show where we pull our favorite phrase from the play and talk through it so that you can nod smugly and knowingly when you hear it in production. The line we chose from Coriolanus is, "Oh, mother, mother, what have you done?" from Act 5, Scene 3. Let's hear the phrase in context. I have sat too long.
Nay, go not from us thus. There's no man in the world more bound to his mother, yet here he lets me prate like one in the stocks. Thou hast never in thy life showed thy dear mother any courtesy when she, poor hen, fond of no second brood, has clucked thee to the wars and safely home, loaded with honor. Say my requests unjust and spurn me back, but if it be not so, thou art not honest, and the gods will plague thee that thou restrainst from me the duty which to a mother's part belongs. This is the last. So we will home to Rome and die among our neighbors. Nay, beholds this boy that cannot tell what he would have, but kneels and holds up hands for fellowship, does reason our petition with more strength than thou hast to deny it. Come, let us go. This fellow had a Volscian to his mother. His wife is in Coriolis, and his child like him by chance. Yet give us our dispatch. I am hushed until our city be afire, and then I'll speak a little.
Oh, mother, mother, what have you done? Behold, the heavens do ope, the gods look down, and this unnatural scene they laugh at. Oh, my mother, mother, oh! You have won a happy victory to Rome. But for your son, believe it, oh, believe it, most dangerously you have with him prevailed, if not most mortal to him. But let it come. Aufidius, though I cannot make true wars, I'll frame convenient peace. That was Oh, Mother, Mother, What Have You Done? From Act 5, Scene 3 of Coriolanus. Daniel, you want to give us a little context on this?
Yeah, absolutely. This is the aforementioned scene where they bring in different people to appeal to Coriolanus to basically, like, stop the tanks that are rolling through. And he ignores the politician, he ignores his friend, and now his mother comes in and appeals to him. And he is completely vulnerable in this moment. And when she says to him, like, okay, fine, do what you need to do. I've said my piece. You will put your family to the fire. And I will not speak again until I am on fire. And when I do, then I might scream. But the last sound I'm making is this statement, that you're not my son.
Woof.
And it breaks him down.
Yeah.
And he cries.
Yeah.
He has a breakdown. And, oh, mother, mother, in that great, you know, that great sense of the O is not an O. It's a sound. It's an emotion. He knows in that moment, we have a nice, we're missing some beats. And then I'll speak a little. Three beats, we're missing five beats. There's something that happens there, but I think in that breakdown, he reveals himself to be a weak and vulnerable, not weak, but a vulnerable
vulnerable
human.
Yeah, to his mother,
And he knows that the world is watching. And she has basically sealed his fate. Like, he will stop this army. But in doing so, she has killed him.
You're an invincible monster until you lose. And then you're vincible.
Very vincible. You know? And once people know you're vincible, they get stronger.
Because we were joking before about Aufidius's army being like, but what if he is there? Like,
that crybaby?
Oh, the mama's boy? We're good. And he knows it, and he's He's
in
like,
this case,
you saved Rome, but I'm done.
In doing this, I can't go back to Aufidius's army and be like, hey guys, we're going to call it off. Because when I do that, they're going to kill me.
And it's a great, and I mean, Aufidius, two lines later, has a great line where Coriolanus is like, now, good Aufidius, were you in my stead, would you have hurt a mother less or granted less, Aufidius? And Aufidius goes, I was moved with all. Which is basically like, like,
or it could be like, that got me too.
No way.
I do have to kill you. You know what? I'm going to kill you.
Maybe. But I mean, that's the joy of Shakespeare. That it could. I think that is absolutely like,
Yep, your mom, huh?
Yeah.
I guess that's going to change the... Your mom said to go home before the lights turn on, so I guess that's what you have to do, most intimidating man in the world.
I see.
You know?
Part of me is like...
I think he's disgusted.
Oh, see? I feel like there could be the opportunity that he's looking at it and going like... It's like watching a fan of another team lose. We're like, do you really... Why are you crying? It's sports. And you're like, oh, wait, if that was me, I'd be crying.
Yeah, maybe.
Like, oh, I see.
There's a lot of room to play.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
But I think this is a great line to look for in production because you have Coriolanus, who's been a rock
Totally.
For 2.5 hours, just a destroyer of worlds.
Yes.
And then it's like, vulnerable.
Human.
Yep, this is the break. You know, even the stage direction, he holds her between when she stops talking and we have those missing beats. The stage direction is he holds her by the hand, silent. Before his line, "No mother, mother."
Hmm? Where does that direction appear?
The direction appears in a little thing called the first folio.
It says he holds her by the hand silent in the first folio?
It says, holds her by the hand silent.
I don't know who does that. I don't have a noun for the verb.
Holds her. It's a scene with two people. I don't even need to do that. So there you go. Keep an eye out for this scene and let us know how it is done in the production you're going to see. Here we will highlight the biggest practical challenge to the director in this play and share a few ideas on how it has been solved in the past. For Coriolanus, we think the biggest challenge is the casting of the various citizens.
Yes.
Daniel, you want to kick us off on this?
Sure. I think... specifically, the first citizen is very difficult to cast because this is a role. It opens the show, Act One, Scene One. This is the first citizen is like the mouthpiece of the revolution,
right
at the top of the show.
Yeah,
and then not disappears, but becomes a far less significant part of the story.
Right.
But you need someone who can carry the show. For 10 minutes at the top. And it's the top of Coriolanus. So I'm not sure that this may have been a challenge 400 years ago.
Yeah.
But nowadays, where you're like, I'm going to see Coriolanus.
Uh-huh.
You're like, I think a lot of folks might be trepidatious heading in.
Yeah.
So it's like, I'll give it 5 minutes.
Right.
It's that whole, like, you read a book for 100 pages and then see if you just give up right there or not. So you can't have just, like, somebody play the part.
Right.
Because they got to carry it.
Yeah.
But then you're also like sitting down to cast an actor like, we're doing Coriolanus. I have a great part for you.
Yeah.
I think you'd be great for it. Like, what is it? Like, first citizen. You're like,
seriously?
Literally go f*** yourself. And it's like, no, but it's a good part.
Yeah.
It's like, I just feel like at this point, there are roles that are hard to cast and roles that are easy. And if it was just a throwaway part, you can cast it. It's actually easier to cast if it's a smaller role.
Right. Or you can take a risk on someone. You can, like, try something out. Yeah.
It's just a really tough spot for first. Like, if we could go back in time, just give this person a name.
Right.
And, like, totally. Like, it would solve it.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, I'm playing so-and-so. They're in the first couple scenes.
Yeah.
But no.
Yeah.
It's like, and I get it because he represents or she represents. The people.
Right. And that's why the masses. It's it's the mouthpiece of the masses. But it is funny. And then what I've found in every production of this that I've seen is you run into the problem that, you know, when Shakespeare is doing these productions, it's usually as a cast of like between 14 to 18.
Sure,
like that's generally what you're working with.
I like to work with 13 because it's an unlucky number.
Of course you do, you unique snowflake. But you know, we start with all these rabble-rousing Romans in the first scene. And just when you're looking at the casting, the actors that you have playing the revolutionaries are going to have to be the Volscians in the next scene, are going to have to come back and be a different set of Romans in a later scene.
Sure.
They're going to have to be the soldiers at some point.
Right.
And it's like when you have an ensemble of six people who are going to have to represent all the rest of the people in the world.
Yeah.
For some reason, I feel like in this play, it's harder than in every other play.
Because they're so different.
Yeah.
The groups that represent are so...
Right.
And they're so at odds.
Yeah, and it's like, because when you're in like Antony and Cleopatra, it's like, yeah, the Roman soldiers can also be a pirate, and then they can be an Egyptian, and it's like, right. Fine.
Right.
But in this, the people are such a big part that it's like, oh, that Volscian soldier is the revolutionary.
Right.
You know?
Right,
and it's like, because you get to know them in I'm sure they're a good character actor if they're good at the...
Yeah.
But you know it's the same guy, and it's always bothered me more than it does in other plays in this
play.
That's
really interesting. It's a similar thing that happens when you go to see a musical. And you're like, oh, the chorus is the chorus of they're all like, here comes the musical number.
Right.
Here are all the people I've seen do, oh, he flipped earlier.
Yeah.
Now he's like doing coal mining. It's like, okay, that's cool.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
Yeah, it's an interesting challenge.
So it's a tough thing. I mean, it's mostly done. I've mostly seen it attempted via the costume. It's like, costume designer, this one's on you. Good luck.
Yeah, right.
And it's like, cool.
Good.
But it's also like,
different looks can we get?
Right. But it's also like, it's totally not worth casting 6 more people so that the Romans look different than the Volscians.
I would cast 400 people.
Of course you would.
I just think that'd be great. Bring everyone down.
Great.
Get, team Volsky.
Get that
team
check.
Ophidius, team.
Great. Find an underwriter.
Right.
Yeah.
That's true. But this is why it's so nice to cast the audience and make them part of the show with Shakespeare. That you're like, hey, everybody, you're Volscians now. Okay, you're this now.
Disgusting.
Thank you.
Pay to play. That is going to do it for this episode. If you found this helpful, please subscribe, rate, and review us in iTunes so we can keep bringing Shakespeare to your headphones on a weekly basis. If you have questions or comments you'd like to send our way, you can find us on the web at www.noholdsbarred.com. You can email us at noholdsbarredpodcast@gmail.com. You can Patreon us at patreon.com. No Holds Barred. You can tweet us at No Holds Barredcast, or you can Facebook us at facebook.com/NoHoldsBarredCast. Until next time, I'm Kevin Condardo.
And I'm Dan Bollier.
Which, to this hour, bewail the injury.
Yet he shall have a noble memory. Assist.
Adieu, adieu, adieu. Adieu, 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 adieu.